From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, could the Russian government be responsible for the Nemtsov murder? A need to change misbeliefs in the Middle East about the West. Possible scenarios that might shape Libya's future.
It's an ongoing civil war and the falling apart of state structures, which is the perfect environment for ISIS to breed.
And satire being used to vent ISIS fear. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The murder of Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov on February 27th has stirred up allegations of who is responsible. Several people have been charged with shooting the staunch foe of Russian President Vladimir Putin, but it has now come into question whether the person who confessed did so under torture. And some opposition forces accuse the government of being behind the assassination. We asked Bob Legvold from Columbia University if that accusation is true.
It could be. It would seem to me a very reckless act, and one that would be rather desperate. And when that first emerged, and people were saying it, you know, it was that close to the Kremlin, must have been the Kremlin that did it, the only way I could think about it was, well, what would be the motive? And then I did realize, or I discovered, because I didn't know at the time, the afternoon I learned of his murder, I didn't know that he was organizing that Sunday demonstration that included protest against the war in Ukraine. And I had not followed Nemtsov's recent activities, so I didn't know that he had become that close to authorities in Kiev, including the current government. That is the kind of thing that would rattle people at the top in the Kremlin. I mean, they are super cautious about any kind of protest against the war or anything that would look like identifying with the Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk government and the process, political process underway in Ukraine. I mean, that's the charges for that kind of thing have been Fifth Column and traitors to Russia and the rest of it. And if Nemtsov was beginning to emerge, since Navalny was under house arrest at that time as a leader of it, that, given their neuralgia on the issue, might have been motive enough to do it. But as I say, I started by assuming it would be extraordinarily reckless on their part to assassinate a personality as prominent as Nemtsov, somebody who had been a prime minister, somebody who had been in a prior government, indeed somebody under whom Putin had served. But maybe that would have been a strong enough motive. So, as I say, these things are always murky. I certainly have no idea of who commanded it, if it was commanded. And in the Russian context, my guess is that it was commanded. And if it wasn't by the people at the center, did it require their at least looking the other way for it to happen? Again, even on that score, I don't know.
Bob Legvold from Columbia University. The state-operated Global New Light of Myanmar says a government-run inquiry will look into violent confrontations between student protesters and police, which sparked global condemnation and raised concerns about the path to reform in Myanmar, also known as Burma. The panel, led by Brigadier General Kwa Twa Ton, is charged with determining whether security forces acted properly in dispersing the protesters and in line with legal procedures, while also seeking measures to prevent such cases in the future. The report is expected to be submitted to President Thein Sein no later than March 31st. The latest clash occurred Tuesday in Let Padan, 140 kilometers north of Yangon. The students are opposed to a draft national education bill they say will stifle academic freedom. The violence prompted a global reaction, including demands for an investigation by the European Union, Britain, and the United States, where spokeswoman Jen Psaki commented.
We urge the government of Burma to respect the right of protesters to assemble peacefully as a means of expressing their views. Freedom of assembly is an important component of any democratic society. We condemn the use of force taken against peaceful protesters. We are deeply concerned by reports of violence by police and other individuals against protesters and journalists in Le Pedon. We are deeply concerned by the reports of arrests and will continue to closely monitor the situation. To your second question, we are Of course, in regular contact with the government of Burma, we've repeatedly called on all parties to exercise restraint. At this point, we are speaking to all the relevant parties and our international partners to ascertain the specific cause of the clashes, and we're also working to confirm the number of individuals arrested and injured.
Two U.S. congressmen, Democrat Joe Crowley and Republican Steve Shumbolt, called on the government to end violent assaults on students, journalists, and monks. In a statement, they said the violence runs directly counter to the pledges made by President Thein Sein to handle disagreements peacefully and to bring forth democratic reforms in Burma. Sean Turnell is a Southeast Asia analyst at Australia's Macquarie University. He tells VOA's Victor Beattie the use of civilian deputies alongside police is a return to the old days when the country was run by a military junta.
These vigilante groups, some of which go under the name of Swin Shin, have been used before, and it's really disturbing to see them being used again. Even apart from those groups, I think the regular police seem to have broken all sorts of internal guidelines when it comes to breaking up peaceful demonstrations.
Myanmar state media announced today, Wednesday, an inquiry into the protest crackdown. Do you expect anything to come out of that?
I'm hopeful. In the past, of course, one couldn't have expected anything, but there are elements within the current Burmese government that would be very unhappy with this, and in particular, of course, that it's gone around the world, and it tarnishes still further the reform efforts that some groups within the country are undertaking. So I'm hopeful that something will emerge from it, but I'd have to say the drift of policy in Myanmar or Burma the last few months has not been good, so my expectations are not high.
To what do you attribute this drift?
Well, I think it's partly the lead-up to the elections later this year, and I think a lot of the old conservative, recalcitrant elements are really beginning to mobilise themselves now, because I think they see that, you know, that the government remains deeply unpopular and that Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the NLD, would split the elections if they were genuinely free and fair later this year. So I think what's going on is a general sort of muddying of the waters, if you like, and leaving the circumstances open, perhaps the elections to be cancelled or in other ways just made to be invalid.
An analyst here in Washington with the Center for Strategic International Studies called the government response to the protesters will seriously hamper the ability of U.S. officials to convince players in Congress that Washington should continue its support for Myanmar's reform process and future development.
I was meeting with Congress people myself only a matter of a month ago, and there was a great deal of disquiet about the way that events in Burma have gone, and very much a desire of the Burmese government on notice that the U.S. support for what seemed to be a genuine reform program for such a long while, that, you know, U.S. support should not be taken for granted.
What is the education reform all about?
The reforms are essentially about establishing a body that will oversee the universities. The big trouble is this body not only centralizes power, but it centralizes power amongst a group of people, that is the people who are on this committee, who very much come from the old regime. So it's not surprising that there's a high degree of distrust with respect to that particular body. But also more broadly, I think students and academics and all sorts of other people concerned with education in Myanmar are very worried about the degree of centralization. Decisions about curriculum, decisions about what language to conduct instruction in, really should be institution-based. I think the language issue is particularly important because one of the big problems is that many of the education institutions in ethnic nationality areas would not be permitted to give instruction in local languages. They would have to give it in Burmese. So that's the sort of thing that really gets people upset at the degree of centralization of decision-making for universities and other higher education institutions.
Turnell says he suspects the violence is a result of the country's forthcoming election, with some in the government seeing instability as an excuse to postpone the ballot. The term of the lower house is 5 years from the date of the first session in January 2011. The last election in 2010 was called by official notification 3 months before the ballot took place. Experts say countering the ISIS propaganda used to recruit members is difficult because it feeds into long-held misbeliefs in the Middle East. We asked Adele Iskander of Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada, why so many Arabs feel they are victimized by Western powers, especially the United States.
It comes from various dimensions. The first is that the region has actually a long history of colonialism. This is a region that's been essentially carved out by the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which led to the creation of multiple states. Many of these states are not necessarily a product of a contiguous, notion of the nation. And so I think that is the sort of the original sin in many instances. But beyond that, I think it also is a function of decades of authoritarian control and the shutting down of any avenues for communication and free expression. So in circumstances like this, the rumor mill is much more effective a way of disseminating information than let's say, freewheeling journalism. In addition to that, there's also a sense of denial. I mean, the changes that have happened over the past 3 years and the real sort of disintegration of some of these states has happened so fast that it's left people in a sort of a dizzying frenzy where they are confused as to what could possibly be, at work here. I mean, the collapse of the Iraqi army in the face of ISIS, the disintegration of Syria in 4 short years, the decimation and fragmentation of Libya, again, in also 3 years or so. I mean, these are extremely shocking instances. And in some cases, the speed and the pace at which this has happened ends up also reinforcing pre-existing theories and conspiracy theories about Western powers wanting to fragment the region or divide it so that it becomes weak or things of that sort. So part of it are sort of remnants of the view that the Arab world or the Muslim world needs to be united. And of course, now it is in greater disunity than any other moment in history. And so that also feeds the conspiracy theories.
Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs Philip Crowley said the U.S. has to bridge the gap in its credibility in the Middle East by matching words with acts. Would that help change the conspiracy mindset in the Middle East?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The contradiction between values and policies is one of the most, one of the most fertile grounds for not only, conspiracy theories, but also justification for brutal actions in the name of confronting the United States or confronting the perceived American imperialism. So the key here is to basically talk the talk and walk the walk. That is usually the most convincing way to deliver a real sort of blow to not only conspiracy theories, but to those who claim that the United States is on the wrong side of history in the region.
Adele Iskander of Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. The European Union's foreign affairs chief told the United Nations Security Council that the Libyan crisis is worsening. Federica Mogherini said the country's feuding political leaders must agree on a national unity government within days, not weeks. In Morocco, where UN-backed talks are underway, UN Special Envoy for Libya, Bernardino Leon, said the negotiations are making progress. He said delegates are holding more talks after consultations at home. The talks are aimed at achieving a lasting ceasefire and putting Libya's democratic transition back on track. Jason Pack, president of London-based LibyaAnalysis.com, warns that if the stalemate between the two sides is not broken, jihadi groups and the self-styled Islamic State would be able to expand their safe havens in Libya. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Pack about the possible scenarios that could shape Libya's future.
Mr. Pack, how did stalemate between the Islamist-aligned Libya Dawn and anti-Islamist Operation Dignity give ISIS a chance to find a foothold in Libya?
Well, similarly to the situation in Syria with the struggle between the rebels and the government of Bashar al-Assad, it's an ongoing civil war and the falling apart of state structures, which is the perfect environment for ISIS to breed. So that's what's happened in Libya. The struggle between Libya Dawn and Operation Dignity creates a vacuum in which groups like ISIS that attempt to control territory beyond the area of a state are able to thrive.
You wrote in a recent analysis that ISIS in Libya is not the product of the dispatch of foreign fighters to the country, but rather a question of rebranding various Libyan groups with whom the ISIS core message and ideology already resonated. Can you explain that?
Some people have misconceptions in the West that ISIS is a group of cohesive fighters that are dispatched from Iraq and Syria to other places. That's not correct. The groups such as Ansar Beit al-Maqdis in Egypt, which is now ISIS-aligned, or the Youth Shura Council in Darna, which is also an ISIS-aligned group, are pre-existing jihadi groups, which at some point may have had al-Qaeda links or other links in the jihadi world, who at some point in 2014 announced their allegiance to the Islamic State. And they did that because they were impressed by the Islamic State's ability to govern territory. They admired the Islamic State. They wanted to copy it, and they expressed their allegiance. And they claimed to then become agents of the Islamic State. But that doesn't mean that those fighters have ever been in Iraq and Syria or that they really take orders from the central base in Mosul.
So could the jihadi groups and ISIS achieve their joint goal to prevent the emergence of a strong Libyan state and have safe havens in a failing state?
Yes, I mean, they are very close to that goal, or they have actually temporarily achieved it. They're able to operate with impunity in Darna and Sirte and elsewhere. Yes, General Haftar is trying to dislodge them from some neighborhoods in Benghazi. But so long as the mediation process is failing and the civil war continues, ISIS is able to hold on to their patches of territory. The position of ISIS in Libya will ebb and flow with the larger conflict between Dawn and Dignity. So long as that conflict continues, ISIS will succeed in Libya.
Would the jihadi groups eventually constitute a third bloc in Libyan civil war with a primary aim to frustrate any compromise solution to the conflict and to provoke outside intervention, which they can then use as a rallying cry for recruitment and launching further attacks?
Well, I think that's already what's happened, so that's a good summary, yes.
How does Libya's geography make it a desirable target for the Islamic State grand scheme?
Well, Libya is at the center of the North African, Mediterranean, and Middle Eastern systems. So they can use Libya to spread jihadism into sub-Saharan Africa. They can use it to traffic sub-Saharan African migrants northward towards Europe. They could use Libya as a launching off point for attacks into Italy. They could potentially attack oil infrastructure. Libya is very, very centrally placed. So that's appealing to the Islamic State. And also, it's going to be difficult for the Western powers to intervene there or support one actor against another in the way that the West has intervened with aerial strikes or training the Iraqi army and the Peshmerga to fight Islamic State in Iraq. In Libya, there's no one to train, and it would be nearly impossible to conduct some kind of NATO operation against ISIS in Libya. So it's a very tough situation.
Final question. Would a successful outcome of the current negotiations between warring factions in Libya deprive the Islamic State from being able to find a foothold in Libya?
I think it would, particularly if one of the conditions of the reconciliation between Dawn and Dignity would be working together to reconquer Sirte, to reconquer Darna. Then Islamic State could be a good rallying cry for different factions to make their unity against it, just as Libya faced a kind of unity when it had to attack Gaddafi together. That brought together different militia groups. So, in theory, struggling against ISIS could do something similar.
Jason Pack, president of London-based LibyaAnalysis.com. The militant group calling itself the Islamic State, also known as ISIS and ISIL, is certainly not known for getting laughs. But both in America and the Middle East, where the group is most active, satire offers people a way to vent their fears and frustrations while also ridiculing the group's horrific excesses. VOA's Adam Phillips examines some videos and comedy shows that spoof the group and asks why such characters can be both appealing and effective.
The war of ideas may be largely fought in cyberspace these days, but the art of satire that thrives there is an ancient method for challenging the status quo and cutting opponents down to size, including groups like the Islamic State. University of Michigan communications professor Marcus Porosky specializes in public argumentation, including satire, and its effects on policy.
Satire is a way of engaging arguments that utilizes exaggeration of the faults of an opponent in order to draw distinctions between my side and their side. It's designed to exaggerate. It's designed to inflict wounds on the other side, and in ridiculing the other side, to highlight the negative aspects of what they are advocating.
Well, this is it. You need any help with your bag?
No, it's all right. I got it.
How about some walking around money?
Dad, it's okay.
Porosky uses the recent satirical sketch broadcast on the popular American TV comedy program Saturday Night Live as a good example. It caricatures a famous Super Bowl commercial where an all-American father tearfully says goodbye to his daughter as she leaves for college. In the spoof's final seconds, the viewer discovers the girl is actually leaving her family to fight with the Islamic State.
At the first level, it's obviously lampooning this phenomenon of young Western people signing up to engage in a jihadist fight over in the Mideast, which is certainly a disturbing phenomenon for Americans and other Westerners. That creates an ambiguity in who we are. And satire can enter into the frame in order to repolice those boundaries by making fun of the ISIS challengers or making fun of the teenagers that go fight on that side.
That video has been seen and apparently enjoyed by millions of Americans, but a few viewers have found it offensive. Jokes about ISIS are not funny, opined one user. See how much you laugh when you have to see your loved ones being slaughtered. No respect. Another tweeted, ISIS sketches just make me uncomfortable. They behead people. I'm not ready to joke about it. But other Americans have tweeted praise. Seriously? Saturday Night Live is being criticized for mocking ISIS and the people who join it? Queried one user. There's no group more deserving of ridicule. Thumbs up. Porosky points out that many satires of the Islamic State come from the Middle East, where the ISIS threat is an everyday reality. This Kurdish sketch satirizes Western music videos. It shows stereotypical Islamic State fighters playing rifles as if they were electric guitars and dancing with skulls and swords.
At that level, these videos are kind of like Charlie Hebdo in France, where there were direct threats against those satirists, and yet they continued to produce the material in a statement of the principles of free speech. So far from saying that it's in bad taste, I mean, you see the effectiveness there of satire as an approach to working through issues.
In a Lebanese video, a clownish Islamic State fighter hails a taxi, then angrily rebukes the driver during the ride for using a mobile phone, a radio, and air conditioning, which had not been invented during the time of the Prophet Muhammad. The driver stops and ejects the fighter, telling him to take a camel instead. Porosky says this comic satire makes a serious point about hypocrisy, where straight rhetoric would be tuned out, resisted, or condemned.
It'd be one thing for someone to get on Lebanese television and say, conservative Islam has a hypocritical relationship with technology because it simultaneously embraces a bygone era and yet utilizes the tools of the Western infidels, right? I could make that argument just straight up, but it's going to be more effective with audiences if I couch it in humor.
Porosky says satire can be taken too far. It can lapse into racism, as when the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo lampooned the Prophet Muhammad, offending all Muslims, not just extreme fundamentalists like the Islamic State. Also, says Porosky, in a more nuanced discussion aimed at peacemaking, the emphasis should be on finding common ground, not differences with one's opponents. But, he says, when it comes to the Islamic State, the gloves must come off. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.